You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, and you are very welcome to Book Lovers Cafe. Book Lovers Cafe is a program of author interviews and book reviews from around the Sound and beyond. I'm your host, Chris Wilson. Today, we are going to be talking to Michael Daly. Now, some of you may have met Michael Daly or heard of him as a poet, a teacher, the founding editor of Empty Bowl. But now we're going to talk to him as an author of a novel, Telemachus. So pretty exciting. This book is really interesting, and it is partially set in Port Townsend. It's the story of a father and son discovering themselves and each other, although they haven't spent much time together. The famous poet is the father, M.M. Baca, known as Mac, and the son is Bobby, an artist. So let's begin with a short reading. Hi there, Michael.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me on your show.
Well, thanks for being here. So I think it's going to be really interesting to hear you read a little bit about it and tell us about this book.
Okay. Well, should I start with part of the first chapter? What I had in mind is that Kurt Vonnegut suggests that every book, every novel should begin at the end. And so I wanted to sort of give an example of that by reading part of the first chapter and then a bit from the end of the book.
Sounds good.
So this is the opening. They found my father, a famous man, sitting upright on a 100-year-old bench at an unfrequented subway stop called Andrew Square in South Boston. Medics determined that the cause of death was his heart and that he'd been dead 12 hours before anyone realized he wasn't waiting for a train, asleep, a vagrant, or a mound of rags beneath a hat. That image, which appeared on the front page of a major newspaper, still haunts me with its caption, "Poet Warrior's Heart Stopped Underground 2 miles from his birthplace." I've tried again and again to paint him, but the minute I begin to mix the gray and silver oils to portray his form leaning against those dull yellow wall tiles, I'm bothered by the question I've been trying to answer since his death. Did he find the last piece of his own puzzle before he sat down to that in that station? Before that picture reached the newspapers, one of his lawyers called me, Johnny. I'd only talked to Johnny on the phone once or twice back when Mac was attempting to pay my tuition fees, but I had a pretty clear image of what he looked like. In my mind, at least, he always wore a baseball cap with his three-piece suit. Took it off for court, of course. He was thin as a rail and moved as fast as he talked. He didn't drink or smoke. And while we were on the phone, he told me he was slowing down his Peloton to give me that regrettable news. "Bobby, I'm so sorry." He was only slightly out of breath. Nobody knows what happened to him. I mean, leading up to the heart attack, you know? "Yeah, I guess." Why did his heart fail on that particular night? You have any idea? Had he been seeing a doctor that you know of? No, I don't think he would do that unless, well, you know how he was, unless he was dragged there in an ambulance. He still smoked and drank like a fish, as far as I know, Bobby. Could he have mouthed off at someone who pulled a knife or a gun and had a heart attack from terror? Oh, well, yeah, I mean, that's your dad. Who the f*** knows what he might do from one moment to the next? Ironic, isn't it? I mean, after a decade in every war zone on Earth, he dies on a quiet bench at a subway station. I wonder if it was grief. Grief? What do you mean, Bobby? Well, maybe he just got tired of seeing so much. He saw enough war and death, you know. Maybe he stopped being able to separate death in the world from his own. Or maybe he was just too lonely to keep going. He had abandoned us and the creaking family home for the last time, as well as our little town in the Pacific Northwest, and returned, as he put it, to the scene of the crime, the Irish-Italian maze of triple-decker houses and potholed streets in Dorchester, where he spent the last 10 years of his life. How long since you've seen him, Bobby? Yeah, you're right, I'm not the best son in the world. All these years and I couldn't make myself do the right thing and visit him. Well, I don't know if you know it, Johnny, but apart from the summer when I was 13, I've only known him through phone calls and letters, important letters, I'll grant him that, to him and to me. And they came regularly beginning after my 6th birthday until that 13th summer. They picked up again after that. I've saved the next 20 years of his letters from some pretty grisly locales, too. Famine, refugee camps, friggin' bullets flying around. You name it, he was there. I'm sure you know all about what he was paid to write poems from the danger zones. Remember when he sent me to the Parisian art school, and he couldn't meet me there because he was in Libya? He changed, you know, said Johnny. He just wasn't the same happy-go-lucky guy after the accident. So I guess when he started diving into those hot spots, he thought he found a way to shake off the misery and the guilt, found some other Mac to put out there in front of the world. You know, he was all about his reputation, right? And you know what I remember about Mac? It was probably one of the first times I ever met him, and I think he might have been testing me. He was drinking, and he was happy. Oh, boy, could he get happy when he wanted to. I thought you didn't drink. I don't. Well, not anymore. But I was kind of young then, and I was meeting this famous guy, so, you know, I thought I could keep up. What happened? Did you get drunk? No, no, not really. Like I said, he wanted to test me, I think, to see how long I could sink before I realized he was putting me on. First thing I ever learned, Johnny, he said, and I'm going to show you. First, you get a good flame off in that cigarette lighter so you can heat the bottle and what molecules cling to the inner walls will just drip down for one or two more tastes, or at least enough to pass around because after all, the liquor store is closed. The truck's out of gas. I just stared at him as he fanned the lighter over the bottom of a bottle of some kind of gin I never saw before, and his eyes lighting up. There, he said. What do you know? You want to try some, Mr. Attorney? I shook my head. I didn't want what he was selling, and I think that's why he hired me after that. Then he said, some days you have to put your eyeball to the mouth of a drained bourbon. That's revelation when you crawl down into the mirror. An empty bottle is never really empty. Anyways, that's old Mac. He quit playing like that over the last, I don't know, 20 years or so. And back in the day, he needed someone he could trust to be his lawyer when the lawsuits were coming at him like flaming arrows. A little later in this chapter, Bobby, the narrator, goes to Scully's funeral home in Dorchester to collect the ashes of his father. Scully's was a sprawling and faded white affair with what might have once been lawn paved over in crackled tar. A few scrawny hedges blocked part of it from the street where a seemingly endless array of plumbers' vans and concrete trucks crawled past. Inside, the lady whose kind voice I remembered from the phone greeted me. She hardly spoke, though, other than to commiserate over what distress I must have been feeling. She was sorry for my loss. I wondered how often in a day she uttered those words. She wasn't the embodiment of kindness I had expected, greeting my sudden entrance in the cold vestibule. She didn't offer to take my coat or serve me tea or anything. She indicated that I could follow her along a carpeted, narrow hallway, where we made a turn into yet another corridor, a long mauve space that looked as though it would go on for miles with panel doors, one after the other on both sides. At the seventh of these, she stopped, opened a door on the left, and beckoned me to enter. She said, I'll give you a few minutes, Mr. Baca, and closed the door so that I was alone in the room with a small card table and a large gray cardboard box. An envelope rested on top of the box with my name on it. A letter from M.M. Baca to me, Robert Hieronimo Baca. Dear Bobby, I don't know when I died, but I made all the arrangements with the Scullies so you wouldn't have to. This should accompany something like an urn with my ashes. I knew Judith Scully in grade school, so they were delighted to get my business. Here's the gist. Though disposing of ashes is illegal, apparently, unless you go miles out to sea, find the best-looking bridge without a streetlight that crosses the Neponset River at high tide in the dark of the moon, and deposit half my ashes in the river. Take the rest of me back with you and drop them in the Pacific. I loved you all my life, Mac. It was a cardboard box with Scully's printed logo, as dry and subtle as memento mori. Releasing the four flaps of the lid, I saw the transparent bag, thick plastic, filled nearly to bursting with ash. They were silken to the touch, with hard knots of what I could only think were remnants of his bones, Mac, unburnable to the very end. I couldn't take my hand away. The ash between finger and thumb, the ash rubbed into my palm, steeping my hands down in there, embedding him into the creases of my knuckles, lifelines of my palm, finally awash in the death of my father.
Chris, I'd like to read the last paragraph of the book if there's time. Is that all right?
Yes, let's hear the last chapter. This will be, you know, a capstone to this reading. You're listening to Book Lovers Cafe and Michael Daly, who's reading from his book, Telemachus.
So at the end of the book, the narrator is recalling when he was about 13, and he came back to his house and sees his father early in the morning sitting at the piano. Mac was naked as a songbird and playing the piano as the sun came up. I was thinking of him just that way when I looked down at my hand where it hovered above the railing at the dark bridge over the Neponset River, my hand gray and the lines along my palm caked by his ash. Human flesh, his human flesh, father flesh, a famous man's flesh and bone. Half his ashes left my hand, a silken veil puffed out and flowing onto that windless night out over the quiet river, muddy as it was, as it always was, I think, muddy stillness itself. Just as, in memory, there he still sits at that piano, the wraith of a murderer chased away from his consciousness by dawn light. It poured into the room, covered his bare chest, his gray hair, long and stringy and sparkling, even his teeth, his eyes, sparkling in first spears of light, and the sun flung over downtown rooftops, glazing windows, gliding over uncut lawns, picket fences, gates hung open, first lights spiked clouds across the bay, and burned them nearly to the shape of a choir of magenta robes. The front windows of 777, their house, shimmered, and down our living room walls crept a new color, like crimson, but not, a color we have no word for. It found my mother asleep on the couch and set her awash in light too immaculate to hope for, smoothed her shoulders beneath my childhood blanket, and it baked my father, finally, without a trickle of fruitful beginnings where he hovered naked above the piano keys, striking them more benevolently than perhaps he ever had, as if to create for the first time that tune, the only tune he played throughout my childhood in every country wherever we alighted, something he made up years before, and the awakened sunlight sculpted his already old and delicate face, which even then, I swear, knew everything. Reassured me fear was pointless, that being uncertain or certain really didn't matter, which was all I could think of when I heard his piano and saw his raving smile crinkle with light.
You're listening to Book Lovers Cafe, and that was Michael Daly reading from his book, Telemachus, the story of two men, father and son, and that really encapsulates really the grittiness of the story, but also the poetic beauty of the story as Bobby tries to understand who exactly his father was. So what was the inspiration for this book, and have you been writing it a long time, Michael?
You know, as I was reading that last paragraph, I realized that was really the first thing I wrote as part of this manuscript. And I had really originally, I think, intended it as the end, as the way the book should end. But I started writing the first draft of this manuscript in 1982 or 83, and got all excited about it, wrote out a whole story, and then it never quite succeeded. I think I never really got to the end, in other words, to match the story up to that particular ending that I just read. But after a while, I set the manuscript aside and tried again, and it became a short story. And I thought that was enough. That's all I really have to write. And it never felt quite satisfying. And about 2 years ago, I guess, is when I decided that I would really sit down and try to finish this thing. I suppose it's not a book that I really expected to be the kind of thing that would appeal to everybody, but it was sort of a compulsion for me to see it to completion.
Mm-hmm. And, so I want to ask you, You're retired now. Was there a difference in your writing and your ability to really concentrate on a project after you stopped working? Did that make a difference?
Yeah, of course, there's more time in retirement. And as a practicing poet for many years, I was able to continue to write poetry as a high school teacher. If a poem or an idea for a poem struck me, I would be able to just carry that with me during the day while I was teaching, sit down, work on it a little bit. But it's very different for prose. And in order to come back to this story, as I tried once or twice over summer vacations, I realized I really need more time. And so when I retired, there it was. You know, it was an opportunity to try to finish something that had been on a back burner for many years.
Mm-hmm. And the structure of the book is interesting as well. Did that come from the beginning, you know, and all the literary allusions that you have in the story? Tell for our listeners, if people aren't aware of who Telemachus is. I think they should be. Can you explain that?
Yeah, in the Odyssey, Odysseus is the main character, of course. I think it's the beginning section of the Odyssey is often referred to as a Telemachia, and it's a story about Telemachus who meets the goddess Athena, disguised as a friend of the family known as Mentor, which is where we get the word mentor.
Mm-hmm.
And a Mentor tells Telemachus he should go and try to find his father. He's now a young man who's either going to inherit the property and the power of King Odysseus, or he's going to have to give it up to these people who want to marry his mother, Penelope. And so he goes off and in search. And at the beginning of my book, there's something like that, where Bobby meets some old friends of Raka,
mm-hmm.
and tries to find out what happened to him in those years when Bobby was growing up and Mac wasn't really available, wasn't home. It sort of follows that.
What came first to you, the characters or the plot or the fact that you wanted to talk about relationships?
I think the characters built their relationships. The more that I knew, well, the more that I tried to write in the voice of Bobby, for instance, the more I discovered that there was this relationship of loss, you might call it, or just memory about his father. And so in thinking of that, you know, what's the memory? That becomes the plot.
Mm-hmm. And letters are important, too. Letters that were written and that time, and now there aren't so many letters.
Oh, yeah, right. People don't really write letters so much. And I think I have Moses mentioning that, but people really don't write letters so much. And he writes something like a 30-page letter that turns into a chapter.
Uh-huh. For a while, I sort of got lost a little bit in Nausicaa, but then I understood why that you know, you had to tell all the whole long story about all those different people back way back when. Who is Nausicaa?
In the story, she is a princess that Odysseus meets, and she and her handmaidens bring Odysseus back to the, I forget the name of the king, and
it's okay.
Who is having
we don't know either.
Right. I'd have to look that one up. And they help Odysseus to get back to his home.
So do women, do they help in this story? Is it mostly a masculine story between father and son and the men that become, you know, part of the story?
I think there's a great deal to be said about the relationship between a son and his mother in the story. I think Bobby reflects a lot on his mother, his memory of that summer when he was 13, and his mother in later life when she has dementia.
Right.
And the way he was struck by her, as I think she's a very powerful person, and I think that has sort of helped Bobby also look for what it is that he wants out of life.
Mm-hmm. I have to ask you about the emphasis on learning Latin. Both Bobby, Mac tries to get Bobby to read and memorize, and then later he writes on a wall in a bar. I was kind of picturing the bathroom in Sirens, but it might have been in Town Tavern, where he writes the quote. Where did that come from, Michael?
What was the original source of that?
Yeah, how did you think of that? Did you ever write on any Port Townsend bar bathroom walls?
No, somebody else did.
Somebody else did. Okay, but
right.
You're not telling.
And I was struck because this was in the Town Tavern. I was struck by walking in and seeing on their chalk wall a whole long passage from Dante. And it's Italian, and I had studied Dante in college, and so I recognized it, and I thought, who would do a thing like that?
Who would do that? Maybe somebody from Empty Bowl, but you also have translated Italian, correct?
Right. I translated a book called Alter Mundus by the poet Lucia Gazzino.
Mm-hmm. So we know there's a Town Tavern in this story. Does anybody go into Salal?
No.
Okay.
No, Salal doesn't show up in the book.
Was the robbery at the beginning of Safeway or at the Penny Saver down by the lagoon?
Well, it's I was thinking of a place kind of like that in that location.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think the actual robbery that I was remembering took place in Hadlock.
Oh. Well, you know, so I just think that's fun for our listeners to think about. And it was interesting for me as a reader. At first, I didn't know it was Port Townsend. You know, I was thinking, well, maybe it's Port Angeles.
Yeah, it's always referred to as a small town in the Pacific Northwest.
That's but true.
I've noticed that, you know, I've never written a novel before, and I don't know if all novelists do this, but for me, I find that it's important to be able to visualize a real place, even though I don't choose to describe it, or I might confabulate it with a couple of places. I sort of need to have some place that I've been in mind, and put fictitious characters there, and you know, be able to change the events.
Right. Yeah. Because that's what makes reading something really come to life and be true. Can't let you go without talking about a current release, of your publishing company called the Mandrona Project. And this is number two. And it is a collection of poetry, Human Communities in Wild Places. And part one is all about the founders of Empty Bowl. Can you tell us and tell, you know, the listeners who aren't familiar with what Empty Bowl was and is before we go?
Okay. Well, first I have to correct you just a little bit. This is the third issue.
the Madrona Project began actually as an, my idea was to promote an empty bowl book called Cathedrals and Parking Lots by Clemens Stark, his collected poems. And I wanted to put together a little brochure for that and got a lot of poets to write poems and comments about Clem and his book.
Mm-hmm.
And there were so many that it became a huge volume, and that became the first Madrona Project.
Okay. I just want to say that we're kind of running out of time, but
okay.
The Madrona Project is, you know, this current edition is a beautiful book. It's got a barred owl on the cover. You'll find it probably at Imprint, or you can order it from, where can they find, from EmptyBowl.org? Well,
EmptyBowl.org or yeah. Small Press Distribution.
Or Small Press Distribution. So the founders of Empty Bowl, some of them
right.
are still alive, but some of them are not. And so this is kind of a tribute to them, the first part. And then some beautiful poems by current poets throughout the Northwest and some of our local
right.
poets as well. People that I've interviewed here on Book Lovers Cafe, I like to interview poets. So thank you very much, Michael, for joining me today. You've been listening to Book Lovers Cafe, a program for everyone who hasn't read everything. Today, we've talked to Michael Daly, the author of Telemachus, Way Out There, a collection of essays, and a poetry book called Reinhabited. Please join me next time to talk more about books and authors. I'm your host, Chris Wilson. You can listen to past shows and other programs from the podcast page or catch up on this one again on the website, kptz.org. Thank you to our engineer and editor, Taylor Clark and Carl Allen, and all the volunteers and supporters who make this wonderful radio station possible.
Today's closing music, All My Days by Alexi Murdoch.
Searching all of my days, all of my days. Many a road, you know, I've been walking on, all of my days. And I've been trying to find what's been in my mind. As the days keep turning into night, well, I have been quietly standing in the shade all of my days. Watch the sky breaking on the promise that we made. Oh,